From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Freddie Fender is one of the few Chicano singers who's topped the country music charts. Now he's singing with the Texas Tornadoes, an all-star band playing Tex-Mex music. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Freddie Fender and the Tornadoes' organist, Augie Myers. Also, we talk to a member of country music's best-known family. Carlene Carter of the Carter family has a new album of new country. Texas-based writer Sandra Cisneros reads from her new work, La Fabulosa, about a Chicano woman with wild ways. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Miller's Crossing, the new film by the makers of Blood Simple and Raising Arizona. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush today accused Iraqi forces of pillaging and looting Kuwait, and his aides say the situation could test U.S. patience, waiting for the economic sanctions against Iraq to take effect. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The president hosted the Emir of Kuwait at the White House today. It was Sheikh Jaber al-Hamad al-Sabah's first visit to Washington. Aides say the Emir told the president that Iraqi soldiers have been pillaging Kuwait, even pulling babies from their incubators so the machinery could be sent to Baghdad. After their meeting, the president once again condemned the Iraqi occupation.
Iraqi aggression has ransacked and pillaged a once peaceful and secure country.
The president said he and the emir agreed that all options remain open in order to restore the legitimate government of Kuwait. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
A young French boy was killed and at least 17 other people were injured last night when suspected pro-Iraqi terrorists threw grenades into two outdoor cafes near a French military base on the Red Sea. The attack occurred in Djibouti, a port town on the Gulf of Aden. France maintains a permanent garrison in the port with 4,000 military personnel and their families. The base has been used as a staging area for French military personnel on their way to the Gulf. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack. There are more signs today that the economy may be heading for a recession. The Commerce Department's index of leading economic indicators fell 1.2% in August. NPR's John Idsty reports.
The index is designed to predict economic performance 6 to 9 months down the road. Its August decline was caused by a deterioration in consumer expectations, falling stock prices, higher unemployment insurance claims, and a number of other factors. The fall in the index was the largest since November 1987, the month following the big stock market crash. But no recession came then, despite the big drop in the index. The rule of thumb economists use is that 3 consecutive monthly declines in the leading indicators signals a recession. Last month, the index did not fall. But given the slow growth in the economy and the steep rise in oil prices, most economists seem to be predicting a recession now. The prominent blue chip forecast says nearly 60% of the economists it surveyed predict a recession in 1990 or 91. I'm John Idsty in Washington.
Congress moved today to expand the test sale of oil from the nation's emergency stockpile. The House passed an emergency bill to increase the sale from 5 million barrels to 15 million. A companion bill has been introduced in the Senate. The Energy Department has formally invited bids on the 5 million barrels that President Bush called for on Wednesday. Delivery of the oil from the test could begin by late October. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 25 points today to close at 2,452.48. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Texas has a special place in the history of rock and roll. It's the home of Tex-Mex, border music that combines the influences of Mexican music and rock and roll. And several of the finest Tex-Mex players have united in a new all-star band called the Texas Tornadoes. It features Doug Somm on piano and vocals, Freddie Fender on vocals and guitar, Flaco Jimenez on accordion, and Augie Myers on organ and accordion. Two of the Texas Tornadoes are my guests. Augie Myers' rhythmic, pumping organ style has influenced many other rockers. We'll meet him later in the show. First, a talk with Freddie Fender. He's best known for his country hits of the mid-70s, Wasted Days and Wasted Nights, and Before the Next Teardrop Falls. Fender is a Chicano, and in the 1950s, he had many regional hits, several which were recorded in Spanish. From the new Texas Tornadoes album, this is Freddie Fender singing a song he co-wrote called A Man Can Cry.
A man can cry. A love can surely die. They're not here to stay. The sunshine and the rain. Let me, oh, oh, let me tell you, baby. The towering mountain high is to prove my love. All this love have I. But let me, oh, oh, let me tell you, baby, I'm still in love with you.
Freddie Fender singing with the new Texas Tornadoes from their new album. It seems to me you really like to sing ballads the best, and I find that interesting since your early stuff was really heavy on the rhythm and blues. Has there been a musical change, or is that just what you think sells best?
See, there's some songs that we're doing now that are ballads, but they have a lot of oomph in
right.
it, a lot of rock in the ballads. I like a ballad with a lot of triplet piano behind me and a strong drummer, a strong bass, and really good fill-in with the guitars, you know? So that's what I like. I like a slow rhythm of blues with a lot of rock background on it.
Freddie Fender, you grew up near the Rio Grande, and you did migrant work as a child. How old were you when you had to start working?
Well, let's see. My father died January of 45. They did not even have the welfare program back then, and my mother was in very dire poverty. And the very first year, it was kind of rough because the war was still going on, and so that we suffered a lot from lack of food, and shelter was not that good. About a year later, she found a man that she could get along with that she liked, and he took us all up north and into following the harvest, sort of the grapes of wrath thing, and that's how we made our living to the. Hell, in 1958, I was still, I had records out and still picking onions in Las Cruces, New Mexico.
How did you start performing?
I started performing at radio stations. We had a little station called KGBS in Harlingen and San Benito, Texas. And we happened to know the DJ. This was 1946, 47. I was 9 or 10 years old. And I'd go over there with a guitar, and it was a big kick for him to see a little kid with a guitar singing.
I know that one of the records you made in the 1950s was a cover recording in Spanish of Elvis Presley's Don't Be Cruel. Whose idea was it to do that in Spanish? Was it your idea to do that?
In a way, I think that I gave the idea to the producer of the session that I did. I was Don't Be Cruel in Spanish. And some other songs, the Elvis Presley hits, because at that time we did not have Elvis Presley imitators. Everybody wanted to imitate Elvis Presley, whether you sang or not. And I had long sideburns, so the producer said, "Hey, let's do some Elvis Presley songs."
Was your image the Hispanic Elvis at the time?
Very much so. I was called a bebop kid, and the Mexican Elvis Presley, believe it or not.
When did you change your name from Baldomar Huerta to Freddie Fender? Why did you change it?
Well, Wayne Duncan, who became my first manager, had a jukebox route that's about as close as he was to the record business. And he said, "I'm going to record you, and you're going to have to get a name where you can look at the jukebox, you'll put a nickel in it." And in other words, not Baldemar Huerta, you know. So I said, well, let me pick a name. So I picked Fender from the guitar and the amplifier, and Freddie just out of the air. Luckily, if you put a Y on Freddie instead of an IE, you will have the same amount of letters on it, which helps a lot when you print it on an album or something. You know, it comes out just right.
Let's go back to 1959 and your recording of Wasted Days and Wasted Nights. Now, you later recorded this in the mid-70s, and it was a big hit. But this is your first recording of it back in 1959.
Wasted days and wasted nights I have left for you behind. For you don't belong to me. Your heart belongs to someone else. Why should I keep loving you?
Freddie Fender recorded in 1959. Not too long after this record was made, you were busted at a club for, what, holding three joints?
I wasn't holding anything, no.
Oh, okay. What was the story?
They found it in the apartment where I lived. They found some, maybe a couple of joints or something like that. And that was the end of that one, you know.
How long did you spend in prison for that?
2.5 years.
Were you able to keep playing while you were in prison, playing music?
Oh, yes, yeah. I kept up with my guitar and played music.
Is it right that you were paroled under the condition that you didn't get back into music?
Not really. I was paroled on the condition that I wouldn't be anywhere where they serve liquor and anywhere they play music except for church. Even in church they serve wine, so I might as well, you know, just seal it up.
I see. So it wasn't that the judge, it wasn't so much that you weren't supposed to play music, it was that you weren't supposed to be around alcohol.
Yeah.
But what effect did that have on your music career?
I still went ahead and played and got away pretty good, you know.
Where'd you play, though, if you couldn't play at places that served alcohol?
Usually beer joints that didn't advertise.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I wouldn't play any public places. I'd just go to beer joints, little hell holes, you know. And nobody would know about it except the people that went there every day.
Well, that's not the best way to get discovered, is it?
No, I was young. I wasn't really thinking that much about discovery. As a matter of fact, my whole life, I have never expected anything, you know. I've just played music, that's all, you know. And if it happens, it happens. If it don't happen, well, hell, I'm still playing, you know. I was shooting for success and waiting for failure without being afraid of failure. Now I fear failure just tremendously. I've gone to the other side now, you know. If I fail, man, I'm going to be real hurt because I know what success is now, and I want it, you know.
Well, in the mid-70s, you had a lot of success with several hits that were especially big on the country charts. I'm thinking of Before the Next Teardrop Falls and your re-recording of Wasted Days and Wasted Nights. You made these records with Huey P. Moe producing you. How did the two of you team up?
Huey who? Never heard of him, Terry. We did some.
Are you on the outs now or something with him?
Yes, and I really don't like to talk to him. You know, with all due respect. Let's put it like this: I pray for him every night. Okay.
Okay, we can.
Bad business. Bad business transactions. Okay, and it just bothers me.
Oh, okay.
Yep. God bless him.
Your songs, I think, were especially big in country music. How did you end up crossing over into country?
It was a project that came from that person we were talking about. From Number Five. Number Five said, "Freddie, I got a song for you, and we're going to record it. I want you to record it." I said, "I don't want to record it. I don't record country music. I'm a rhythm and blues guy, and I'm not going to do it." And he said, "Well, look, we were recording an R&B album. You're not going to get back to the R&B album you're doing until you finish this." And they played it for me, and I learned the words. And in 20 minutes, I had put it down in English and Spanish, and it was the original. It didn't have the accordion at that time. The music was there already. They just added the accordion later on, and that was, I think it's all about 3 million.
Was it hard in any way to get accepted in country music? Are there ways that you always felt like an outsider?
I think that before they knew what was going on, my song was number one, it was too late. They had, I don't think they had a choice on whether they should accept me into their society or not. And you know, before they knew it, most of them didn't think that I was Hispanic. They didn't know. And before they knew it, my song was number one, not only in country, but in pop. And then after that, you know, well, you know, for better or for worse, they all know Freddie Fender now.
I've been speaking with Freddie Fender, and he's one of the members of the new group Texas Tornadoes, along with Doug Sam and Flaco Jimenez. And Augie Myers, who's featured on both accordion and organ on this new album, is with me as well. And I'll be speaking with him after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. With me now is Augie Myers, and he's featured on the new Texas Tornadoes album. And Augie Myers for years played organ with the Sir Douglas Quintet, and he plays organ and accordion on the new album. And just to give you a sense of this terrific organ playing, let's listen to What Were You Thinking Of from the new Texas Tornadoes album. My guest, Augie Myers, featured on both accordion and organ on that recording. You overdubbing on that?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to. you really use organ as a rhythm instrument. I was wondering how you started playing organ that way.
I don't know. My main instrument, I guess, years ago was piano, and that was the first Vox organ that was ever in America. I bought in 1962. And I didn't like the way it sounded trying to play solos on it, so I just started playing rhythm on it, just used it as a rhythm instrument.
I think a lot of people picked up on that. Who, did you have anybody to pick up on? I mean, had you heard organ played that way before?
No, no way. I listened to, I guess my piano players way back then was Moon Mulligan and then Ray Charles. A lot of people don't know Ray Charles played with Guitar Slim. He was called R.C. Richardson way back then. And he played a lot of shuffle stuff, and it was mostly rhythm. Piano was mainly used as a rhythm instrument way back in the blues era. And that's what I mainly play is rhythm.
I'm trying to remember what year 96 Tears was made, because that also had great organ as rhythm.
Well, those people used to sit back and listen to me.
Oh, okay, yeah, so you influenced the people who made that record.
I can't remember that. I remember the Jimmy, the drummer, asked me that was 1966 that was made that year. But they listened to us play and asked me, I programmed the 96 Tears organ thing for them, how to get the tone that they wanted on the record.
Oh, really? You play Vox and Hammond B3 on the new record.
Right.
What's the difference between the two and what you can get out of it?
Oh, a lot. I mean, no, a Hammond B3 is, you know, it's like a milkshake, you know, with whipped cream and ice cream, and a Vox organ is just a glass of water, but a good glass of water. So there's a lot of difference between that. I mean, you got more sounds out of the Hammond organ for rhythm and blues and jazz and stuff, where Vox was mainly used for a lot of the English stuff.
This is one of those little organs that kind of stand up.
Right.
like a small keyboard.
Right.
So you were the first person in the States to have a Vox organ?
Right.
How did you become the first person to do that?
Well, I used to prescribe to a lot of English magazines back in the early 60s just to check up and see what's going on. And I remember it was $285, and a man, God bless him, he's gone now, but he owned a music store in San Antonio named Mr. Woods. He helped me get it. It was $285. Then after the Beatles and the Stones and Dave Clark Five and everybody came out, they ran up to like $1,500. I still have my original one. I've got four of them. And if anybody out there has got one, want to sell it, please let me know. I like to buy them all.
Oh, really? So did this make you in demand, having this new sound and new instrument?
For a fact, yes, it did. And I remember when me and Doug first went to England in the 60s, George Harrison and Lennon, John Lennon, called the hotel and wanted me to come to the studio because they wanted to see how they had a Vox organ, but they couldn't get the sound that I had out of mine. They couldn't get their sound out of theirs. But it was only due to the amplification. They didn't have reverb in their amplifiers back then. The reverb was a new thing that came out.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you had polio as a child.
Yeah, I tell them from when I was 2 years old till I was almost 10, I had polio. I couldn't walk.
So you didn't start walking until you were around 10?
Until I was about 10. So I live with my grandparents, and when they used to go out in the field every day and pick cotton, they took me over to this black lady's house, and her husband picked cotton for my grandfolks, and they had a piano, and he played in their church, in the black church. But they used to set me up on a piano just to pacify my time away all day, and that's what I did because there was no TV back then. They didn't have radio or electricity in the house.
Were your hands and fingers strong enough to play?
Well, my right one was. My left one was a little affected by the polio, but my grandfather, I owe it all to him. He made me walk again, plus the good Lord, you know. But my grandfather, he did his home remedies on me.
So do you think learning to play when one hand was still weak affected the way you ended up playing, you know, the style that you ended up having?
Well, I think so because I do a lot of rhythm on my right hand, and my left hand just kind of hits you know, the dominant card on there. I still have problems. I do therapy. I play. That's why I bought my accordion for therapy and for my hands and my fingers, and I learned to play guitar that way too.
Did you get full strength back in your hands?
Well, put it this way. I appreciate what I got. If I had any more, I don't know what I'd do with it.
How did you meet Doug Somm, who you played with for many years and are still playing with on the Texas Tornadoes record?
Well, his folks traded in my mother's grocery store, and he used to come there and buy all his baseball cards. And I was a sack boy, and that was it. That was enough. We were 14, 15 years old.
One of the like great rock and roll stories was how when you were produced by Uwe Moe, how he wanted to pass you off as a British invasion group.
Who?
Yeah, do you feel that way also?
No,
are you into the Who?
No. Freddie just looked at me and said, Who? I just said, Who?
Okay.
Huey wanted to pass. But, I mean, it was really hard because there was two gringos and three Mexicans in the band, you know, and trying to get these Spanish dudes to sit there and try to, you know, I like a spot of tea, you know, and try to talk English when they'd sit there and say, hey, what the, man, what time is it, man? Let's go get a beer, you know. And that was their kind of accent, you know, so trying to be English. It pulled it off till Trini Lopez on, I think it was Hullabaloo, said, man, they're from Texas, you know.
Augie Myers is my guest, and he plays organ and accordion on the new Texas Tornadoes album. Well, what is your ethnic group? What's your ethnic background?
Gemini.
So am I.
Freddie Gemini, too. No, what do you mean my ethnic background?
You know? Well, I'm thinking, you know, you're a gringo playing a lot of, you know, Tex-Mex, Mexican-inspired music. So, I wasn't sure what your ethnic background is.
I'm a German and Polish.
German and Polish. Okay.
Yes.
So you probably heard the music of a lot of different ethnic groups growing up in Texas.
Oh, yes. Well, back, I guess Freddie can say, when we were growing up in Texas, there was either country music or Spanish music. I mean, there was no, you know, then all of a sudden M.O.R. came in, which was Little Richard and Elvis Presley, you know. So we kind of combined all three of them.
Well, you know, why don't I play something that's kind of half Spanish? This is a song that you wrote called Hey Baby, ¿Qué Pasó? Do you want to say anything about the song and about...
Well, I mean, I wanted to write something that was, you know, at one point nobody would play my records back home because I either had the country station wouldn't play it, it had horns on it. The rock station wouldn't play it because I had a fiddle or steel. The Spanish station wouldn't play it because there was no Spanish in it. So I just did the Que Paso, you know, to half English, half Spanish, put a little accordion in it. Actually, I wrote that song about one of my girlfriends running off with my best friends.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I miss him, too, because we used to go out and shoot pool and drink beer.
Well, this is the version of it from the new Texas Tornadoes record, and it features Augie Myers on vocals, accordion, and organ. Freddie Fender is on electric guitar, and here we go.
You can hear him yelling in the background, too.
Okay.
Hey, baby, que paso? Thought I was your only vato. Hey, baby, que paso? Please don't leave me desimoso. Come on, baby, turn around. Let me see your pretty blue eyes. Don't you know that I love you? Hey, baby, que paso? Thought I was your only vato. Hey, baby, que paso? Won't you give me un beso?
So Augie Myers on organ, accordion, and vocals, and the aforementioned Freddie Fender yelling in the background there. Well, let me ask you both now, Freddie Fender and Augie Myers. Is this Texas Tornadoes group exposing you to different audiences than you're used to because of the conglomeration of people on it and the way the tours are being booked?
I think it's exposing Freddie to a whole new audience more. Because, I mean, we're playing to the same kind of audiences. Am I right, Freddie? You think so?
Yes. Well, being considered country artist only for so many years.
Country crooner,
romantic crooner. Now, for the first time, I'm gigging with these guys, and I'm playing the guitar. I'm picking some blues and some hot, funky stuff that I hadn't done in years, like I told you. You know, I started out with that kind of music. Then I went into country, and it seemed like I couldn't get out of it because all my bookings were country audiences. But when I got in with the Tornadoes, now I'm getting the bookings. 99.9% of the bookings are bookings that Augie and Doug were doing before, and now I'm doing. But we're playing some real raunchy rock and roll places, man.
Well, I want to thank you both very much talking with us, and I wish you the best. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
Freddie Fender and Augie Myers are now on tour with the new band, the Texas Tornadoes. The all-star band also features Doug Somm and Flaco Jimenez. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is the new single by the Texas Tornadoes. It's called Adios Mexico and features Doug Somm on lead vocals.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Good
Coming up, Mexican-American writer Sandra Cisneros reads from La Fabulosa, her Texas operetta about a wild Chicano woman. As a member of one of country music's most respected families, Carlene Carter was weaned on country music. But like most teenagers during the 60s and 70s, she listened to rock and roll. Coming up, Carlene Carter tells us how she strayed from her musical roots, but returned when she was ready for country music and it was ready for her. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Miller's Crossing, starring Albert Finney and John Turturro. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Congressional and Bush administration negotiators will continue to meet over the weekend, trying to reach a deficit reduction agreement in time to avert automatic across-the-board spending cuts and a government shutdown scheduled for Sunday at midnight. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
Though congressional negotiators from both political parties insist that they are getting close to a budget agreement, an agreement is still not in hand. And as rank-and-file members of both parties hear the details of the package, they find much to oppose. At a House Democratic caucus today, members accused their leaders of abandoning Democratic principles in their readiness to accept massive domestic spending cuts while accepting some form of relief in the capital gains tax. Republicans, meanwhile, are balking at the inclusion of any changes in tax rates and expressing their anger at their leaders' readiness to strike a deal on the capital gains tax. Still, congressional negotiators express confidence that an agreement can be reached in time to pass legislation staying the budget acts if the White House wants it. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
In New York City, the foreign ministers of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council met with the Secretary General today and afterward issued a statement demanding that Iraq unconditionally pull out of Kuwait. The foreign ministers pledged to seek a peaceful solution to the Gulf crisis. Linda Fasulu reports from the UN.
Secretary of State James Baker and the foreign ministers of Britain, France, China, and the Soviet Union were guests today at a luncheon hosted by the Secretary General. Afterwards, in a statement, they reaffirmed their support for UN measures censuring Iraq for its invasion of Kuwait. While pledging to seek a peaceful end to the crisis, the ministers reiterated Security Council demands that Iraq immediately withdraw from Kuwait, restore the legitimate Kuwaiti government, free all hostages, allow all foreigners to leave, and respect diplomatic immunity. The five ministers expressed their readiness to participate in future Security Council meetings. They also reaffirmed their support for negotiations leading to a just and lasting peace in the Middle East. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Fasulo reporting at the UN.
Spain and South Korea are the latest countries to close their embassies in Kuwait. In spite of short supplies and Iraqi troops outside their compounds, diplomats are still in 15 missions in the occupied country. Most embassies have been under siege since August 24th, the Iraqi deadline for foreign missions to close and move to Baghdad. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 25 points to close at 2,452.48, on volume of 201 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 4-3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. A little later in the show, we'll talk about country music with Carlene Carter. But now we have a story from Sandra Cisneros. Cisneros is considered one of the most important contemporary Mexican-American writers. Her collection of stories, House on Mango Street, won the 1985 Before Columbus American Book Award. Next spring, Random House will publish her new book, Woman Hollering Creek. It's the first time a major publishing house contract has been awarded to a work of fiction by and about Chicanas. Cisneros is based in San Antonio, Texas, but describes herself as a migrant professor, traveling around the country, teaching at different universities. Here's Sandra Cisneros.
You know, this story came to me, I suppose, on one of my many rides from San Antonio to Laredo, when I have to listen to a lot of tapes, and I'm especially fond of listening to the Carmen tape on that route. And a friend of mine, Ana Castillo, a fellow writer, had commented about how is it that any time you see a woman in works of art or in stories, any time you find a woman who's powerful or who is in control of her destiny, she always dies at the end. And I thought about that, and we were both fond of the Carmen character, but it's true, she does die at that last scene. And I said, well, you know, what if we were writing these stories? How would we write them? And that's how this operetta was born. La Fabulosa, a Texas operetta. She likes to say she's Spanish, but she's from Laredo like the rest of us, or Lardo, as we call it. Her name is Berriozábal, Carmen. Worked as a secretary for a San Antonio law firm. Big chichis. I mean big. Men couldn't take their eyes off them. She couldn't help it, really. Any time they talked to her, they never looked her in the eye. It was kind of sad. She kept this corporal at Fort Sam Houston. Young, a looker. Jose Arambide. He had a high school honey back home who sold nachos at the mall. Still waiting for him to come back to Harlingen, marry her, and buy that three-piece bedroom set on layaway. Dream on, right? Well, this Jose wasn't Carmen's love of her life. Just her San Antonio thing, so to speak. But you know how men are. Unless you're washing their feet and drying them with your hair, they just can't take it. I mean it. And Carmen was a take-it-or-leave-it type of woman. If you don't like it, there's the door. Like that. She was something. Not smart. I mean, she didn't know enough to get her teeth cleaned every year or to buy herself a duplex. But the corporal was hooked. Her genuine guaranteed love slave. I don't know why, but when you treat men bad, they love it. Yeah, sure, he was her sometimes, sweetheart. But what's that to a woman who's 20 and got the world by the eggs? First chance, she took up with a famous Texas senator who was paving his way to the big house. Set her up in a fancy condo in North Austin. Camilo Escamilla. You maybe might have heard of him. When Jose finds out, it was a big escándalo, as they say. Tried to kill her. Tried to kill himself. But this Camilo kept it out of the papers. He was that important. And besides, he had a wife and kids who posed with him every year for the calendar he gave away at Christmas. He wasn't about to throw his career out the window for no fulanita. According to who you talk to, you hear different. Jose's friends say he left his initials across those famous chichis with a knife. But that sure sounds like talk, don't it? I heard he went AWOL, became a bullfighter in Matamoros just so he could die like a man. Somebody else said, she's the one who wants to die. Don't you believe it? She ran off with King Kong Cardenas, a professional wrestler from Crystal City and a sweetie. I know her cousin Lerma, and we saw her just last week at the Floor Country store in Elotes. Hell, she bought us a beer. Two-stepped and twirled away to, hey, baby, ¿qué pasó?
Sandra Cisneros' new collection of stories, Woman Hollering Creek, will be published by Random House next spring.
Hey, baby, ¿qué pasó? Won't you give me uno beso? Hey, baby, ¿qué pasó? Thought I was your only vato.
This is Fresh Air. Carlene Carter belongs to one of the great popular music families in America. Her grandmother, Mother Mabel Carter, was a member of the original Carter family that toured the country, spreading the sound of Appalachian ballads and gospel. Her mother, June Carter Cash, kept the family tradition going. But rock was more to Carlene's beat when she started performing on her own. Her first solo album featured British rockers Graham Parker and Nick Lowe, to whom she was married for several years. Lowe produced her 1980 album, Musical Shapes. Her new album, I Fell in Love, is strongly influenced by her country roots. Here's the title track.
Hey, I hit town without a clue. used to say that you thought your records were too rock for country and too country for rock. Do you still feel that way?
No, not anymore. I think country radio has really come around a lot and that it's opened wide up for people like me. Actually, there used to be a time when, you know, females with energy were considered rock no matter what kind of music they were playing. It was all, you know, like in the early 80s, late 70s, when I first started, it seemed like country music back then was more M.O.R., kind of slick strings and pop. And I really, you know, felt much more real, rootsy kind of music back then. But I haven't really changed that much since like 1980 to 1990. It just seems that things have turned around a lot.
I Fell in Love is your first album, and I think it's 5 years.
Yeah.
Why did you take a hiatus from recording?
Well, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, to be honest. I was a little bit disillusioned with myself in that I couldn't seem to fit in anywhere. I mean, there's no way, as hard as I, you know, tried to conform, I never could conform to anything. I just always, like, tried to be true to myself. And because of that, I didn't get any airplay. So after making 5 albums... that didn't do anything, I knew that the next album I made, I needed to make sure it was something that was going to be successful or you know, get some attention. And because you can only get away with that for so long, you know, making records that don't sell and making records that a few good friends think are fine. But so I took some time and I just concentrated on my songwriting. I moved back to America. I got my personal life a lot more together in that, you know, I had a home and I stopped running around so much. And, you know, I used to travel a whole lot. I'd be like in L.A. and then I'd be in Nashville and then I'd be in London. And I didn't really, wasn't real settled any place. And I think you kind of have to be settled to focus in on your music.
During your break from recording, didn't you spend some time singing with your family?
Yeah, I did. When I moved back to Nashville 4 years ago, I kind of wormed my way into the Carter family. So I spent 2 years working with them on the road with the Johnny Cash Show. And it was really fun. It was like there wasn't a pressure on me to be an artist, so to speak. And I was able to be a part of something that was really beautiful and really rewarding to me to sing that kind of music.
Did you relate to the music differently then than you did when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Well, when I was a kid, it was just like something my mom did. You know, it was my mom's job. And, you know, I was so used to it. My grandmother, my mom, my aunts, everybody in my family was in country music. And I kind of took it for granted. It took actually moving to England and Dave Edmunds saying to me, "Hey, do you know George Jones?" for me to like sort of go, "Hey, maybe country's kind of cool." You know, I was like a normal teenager and I listened to rock music all the time. You know, I listened to Top 40 radio and went to all the sock hops in Hendersonville High, and, you know, I was dancing to the rock and roll stuff. So my first band was a rock and roll band when I was 12 with my cousin, and we were playing things like Sunshine of Your Love. So I wasn't really grounded in country music like a lot of people think, and it took me coming back to America and working with them to learn about where I really did come from and actually to start appreciating it.
Did you sing with the Carter family when you were a child?
Yeah, not by their choice, really. They used to, like, be on stage, and my mom would sit me and my sister Rosie on the side of the stage and say, "Now, you stay here, and Mom will be off stage in a minute." Next thing she'd know, she'd turn around, and I'd be standing there right next to her dancing on the stage. And then they started letting me sing a song. I think I was about four. They started letting me do that old song, "Charlie Brown, He's a Clown." You know, that one,
"Fee, Fi,
Fo, Fum, I Smell Smoke." Yeah. So even then, you know, I wasn't like conforming to the traditional country music.
So what was it like to be a child on the road traveling with the family?
I was car sick a lot.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, that's like one of my most vivid memories is being car sick. But I don't know. It's, in a way, it's like conditioned me to be able to go on tour for long periods of time and it not bother me. I can fall asleep anywhere. That's one of the things. You know, I can sleep in a car, I can sleep in a bus, I can sleep in a train, I can sleep in a plane. But and most everybody gets real uncomfortable, but I don't have a problem with it. And I know that came from it. Being a kid is like, I missed, you know, I wanted to be normal like everyone else. And I remember like kind of resenting not being able to play softball and because I had to go on the road when I was on weekends because Mama wanted me to be with her. And, you know, I'd always want to be with Mama, but also I kind of wanted to be a normal kid and have this mom and dad that made dinner and set dinner every night. And but, you know, that was normal to me then, so it didn't seem that weird.
You have a song on the new album called Me and the Wildwood Rose about you and your sister singing with your grandmother and the family.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the song.
Well, it's really about being there and seeing it all happen. When my producer's name is Howie Epstein, and he has really encouraged me in broadening my writing into, you know, and trying to stop me from writing all these songs about relationships, which seemed to have been the real focal point for me for a lot of years. He suggested that I write about when I was a kid and what it was like, and write about my grandmother a little bit and family things, and because he knew how much she meant to me and how much a part of my life she was. Rosie is also a very important part of my life. We were, you know, being kids in a musical family, you know, even though we went with them a lot, we also were home a lot. And we, you know, tended, I was a little mama. I kind of took care of Rosie, and she was always my baby, not my mama's.
Eventually rebelled against your family, didn't you? Didn't you run away at the age of 15?
No, I didn't run away. I just, you know, you're either dumb or you're pregnant when you get married at 15, and I was both. So, yeah, I got married at a real early age, and I wouldn't change a thing. I wouldn't change that at all because I have a beautiful daughter who's 18 now, and you know, I lived my life real fast. I was always in a real hurry to get everywhere, and that, you know, I had two kids before I was 20, and those are my two children. And I seemed to spend my youth in my 20s, as in like having a teenagehood time. But I didn't really particularly rebel. I just was anxious to get on with my life.
How did your life change when I think you were 12 when your mother married Johnny Cash?
It was pretty different. We grew up. I actually live in the house that I grew up in until I was 12. I've moved back to that house. But we, you know, we mowed our yard. We mowed our fields. We took care of all the grounds, so to speak. And we always had a lot of work to do. We had a little farm. And when Mom married John, we basically just packed our suitcases with our clothes in it and left everything at our home. And it was like, whoa, you know. Culture shock, because suddenly, you know, that was at the height of his career. Suddenly we were in limos all the time and, you know, traveling first class in airlines. And it was real, real different. And but that's something else I wouldn't have changed for the world, because I got to see a lot of different places. I got to meet a lot of different people that I never would have met had she not met him. Plus, he's a great guy and he was a really good daddy to us.
So what direction do you see your music heading in now, more toward rock or more toward country?
Oh, I'm country. Definitely country. I'm really excited about starting the next record. We're going to start in January. I know that might sound fast to a lot of people, but it does take a while to make them. And, you know, I'd like to have another record out same time as I had one, you know, like another year down the road. But I don't think I'll ever be considered a rock artist. I have no desire to be. And my songs come from a place that country music is at. And country is a great place to be because it's a format that you can say anything you want to. You can write songs about anything you want to. There really are no rules. And a lot, you know, there was a lot of years there that I thought there was more rules to country than there are. So I'm happy being country.
Does your mother feel like you've come back to the fold?
Oh, yes. And she will say, she's come back to the fold. Having interviewed her, I'm sure you recognize that tone of voice. No, she's great. I think she's real proud of me. I think she is.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you, Terry.
Carlene Carter's new album, I Fell in Love, is on Reprise Records. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Today I have three conversations, actually, with an oil trader on the floor of the New York Mercantile Exchange. Most of the day for him was quiet and steady, and then a big spurt of activity around 3 o'clock when Congress moved to release more oil from the Strategic Oil Reserve. Robert Siegel talks with Shelby Steele, author of a new book about race relations in this country. A conversation about Larry O'Brien, Lawrence O'Brien, the former commissioner of the National Basketball Association and veteran political operative, has died at the age of 73. Also a talk with Vincent Palumbo. He is the last stone carver at the Washington National Cathedral.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Miller's Crossing, the movie that opened this year's New York Film Festival, is the latest collaboration by the brothers Ethan and Joel Cohn. As with their earlier collaborations, Blood Simple and Raising Arizona, Joel directed, Ethan produced, and they wrote the screenplay together. Stephen Schiff has a review of Miller's Crossing.
The Cohn brothers have always been precocious put-on artists. Their first two movies were broadly satirical, but they were also so expertly made, so full of vigor and invention, that you had to wonder what these guys would do if they made a serious movie. With the brilliant Miller's Crossing, they finally have. Typically, this darkly beautiful gangster thriller is studded with put-ons and wisecracks, but the satirical elements don't take away from the movie's darkness. They only make it richer. The title hints at what the Coens are up to. Miller's Crossing is a web of crossings and double crossings, all set in a surreal Prohibition-era city that always looks eerily deserted. At the center of the movie is Tom, played by Gabriel Byrne. He's the right-hand man to the Irish gang boss, Leo, played by Albert Finney. But at the beginning of the movie, we meet a rival gang leader, an Italian named Casper. Casper wants Leo to do him a favor. He wants him to knock off Bernie, an unscrupulous Jewish hood the gangsters invariably refer to as the Shmata. Tom advises Leo to go ahead and do it, but Leo mysteriously refuses, and that refusal quickly makes waves all over the city. Eventually, Tom himself is even kicked out of Leo's gang. Naturally, the Italian mobster Casper decides he could use the services of a guy who was so recently the confidant of his chief rival. Here he is offering Tom a deal.
All you gotta do to show you're a friend is give me Bernie Birnbaum. You know it's the right thing anyway. The Shmata steals from me. I can't have Leo giving him a shiny new penny.
So the deal is I give you Bernie, smooth it over with Leo, and you bail me out with Lizard.
Yeah, and we're all friends again. You, me, Leo, the Dane.
We can maybe have tea sometime.
Come on, Eddie. Friends is a mental state. Wait a second.
I'll think about it.
I'll think about it. You hear that thing? The kid's a thinker. That's terrific.
Does he want a pillow for his head?
What is that slang they're using? Part Damon Runyon, part Dashiell Hammett, it's a gorgeous invented music, and the Coens play it for all it's worth. This is one of the funniest, most deftly written screenplays in recent memory. And yet, as the amazingly convoluted plot unfurls, the laughter blends into a melancholy that's almost metaphysical. Tom begins moving between the gangs like an Irish yojimbo, trying to keep control over a situation that's always spinning out of hand. The movie's chief symbol is his hat, which keeps flying away from him, and which he has to hold on to because it's the key to his identity. When he has that hat, he can conceal what's going on in his head. And as long as nobody knows what he's up to, Tom can be in control. Control is the name of his game. That control means that Tom is ultimately unknowable. And unknowable heroes are exasperating to audiences. But Gabriel Byrne is the sort of actor who thinks with his eyes. He draws you into his opaque character, and the effect is hypnotic. The other actors, meanwhile, are busy giving the wildest, juiciest performances of a lifetime, especially John Polito as the childish and wily Casper, and the outlandishly sleazy John Turturro as Bernie, the guy Casper wants dead. Miller's Crossing isn't always easy and ingratiating, but it really works. It's a movie for people who don't mind having to think a little for their thrills.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair. Miller's Crossing is now playing in New York and opens around the country in October. Our reviews and readings are produced by Naomi Person. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews, with production assistance from Sue Spolin and Rossanne Bucci. Special thanks to Fred Landerl. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with actor Dick Miller. He got his start working in Roger Corman's now classic low-budget quickies like Bucket of Blood and Little Shop of Horrors. And journalist A.C. Green tells us about his new life with another man's heart. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Of the celebrated jazz team of Jackie and Roy, Mr. Roy Kroll.